Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome back to Renee's Heart to Heart. This is Renee. I hope everybody had a beautiful, beautiful love and family and friend-filled Christmas. The Brewer household was pretty quiet yesterday. We celebrated Christmas Eve. There was probably 40 of us here at my house, mostly family. A lot of friends that would normally come by this year were doing things with their own families. So I missed having some of them here, but a few of them stopped by and it was beautiful. I am always grateful for family, and I am twice as grateful for friends. So, I chose a topic about 2 weeks ago for today, and I think it was on my mind, of course, because what was going on with my sister who passed on Saturday. It's about life support and palliative care. And of course, while my mind was immersed in this topic, I watch the news very early in the morning, usually the 5 o'clock news, and I saw this story about a 13-year-old Northern California girl who went into the hospital for a tonsillectomy, and somehow that doesn't seem to be real clear. She started bleeding in her brain and was in a comatose state. So there was, I guess, physicians involved and medical personnel wanted to remove her from life support. And they went to court to get a judge to say that she should be removed. Well, this prompted my investigation into really who has that right. I think everybody knows about a living will. I was shocked to find out on the internet that there's lots of controversy about the legalities of a living will. I signed a living will several years ago when I went in to have back surgery. I mean, there's no way that I wanted to have back surgery and have something happen and be incapacitated for the rest of my life and, you know, have them keep me alive under any other means but my own. So when I read all these articles, and there's so many, and they're so convoluted, and in each state, there's so many kind of like continuums. Well, if this happens, you can do this. And if that happens, you can do that. And I was like, oh, my God. I dare say that most people trying to read this or to evaluate the way this is orchestrated, they'd have great difficulty because it's not black and white. It's a very, very strange shade of gray, and it depends on where you are. So I still have so many questions. I researched for several hours last night and pulled some things off that I thought were the most, the clearest and the most pertinent to the actual question I was trying to get answered. My real question is, who holds that right? And of course, if we're talking about the elderly, sometimes if somebody's in their 90s, there is no family. There is no guardian. There is nobody. A child, I always presumed the right to make that decision lay with the parents or the legal guardians. Well, all of those things are true sometimes and not true other times is what I found out. I'm going to bring in Shelley, and then I'm going to read the story of this California girl. So you can decide for yourself if you want to research this and find out what really is happening, because this is a time in our lives where there are many, many amazing things that can be done for people, which opens up lots of other questions. But if there is no recorded brain activity, you cannot breathe on your own. You have other things such as brain bleeding or internal bleeding that can't be stopped. There are some decisions that seem kind of, you know, in your face and cut and dried. However, as a parent and a grandparent, I realized that those decisions are still very, very difficult to make. There was no question while my sister was ill. She made it very clear to all of us what she wanted and what she didn't want. So we didn't have to make any decisions. So palliative care was set up at a hospice care, and there was also never any question as to how often, how much she could receive pain relief. So it was, there were not a whole lot of decisions to make. And even with that, it didn't make the procedure any easier, but we were clear on what she wanted and what we would make sure happened for her. So I'm going to bring Shell in and say good morning, and then we're gonna read this story about this 13-year-old child, and then we'll discuss this at greater length. Good morning, Shelley. I hope your Christmas was awesome. My dashboard says she's here, but I don't hear her voice.
Sorry about that. I had you on mute.
You know, I hear my dog scratching his side a minute ago. You have to quit saying that, because there's probably a lot of people in this world that would love to put me on mute.
Yeah. Well, I'm not one of them. But, yeah, no, I had a very nice day. Had a nice day. Played games with Mom. My mom loves card games and board games, and we have a Yahtzee card game and a thing called Sequence, which is a lot of fun, and then we play a card game called May I, which is actually a three or more person game, but I changed the rules and turned it into a two-person game so my mom and I could play it, and it's just as challenging. So I actually created a two-person
game. Oh, that sounds like fun.
Yeah, it is fun. You have to play like there's seven rounds. In each round, you're going for different card hands, and then the winner of each hand, and then at the end of the game, you see who won the most out of seven hands by points. So it's a fun game.
Yeah, it sounds like it is. It sounds like it is. I always liked board games and card games. My grandma was an avid card player, and she taught me how to play Rummy, Canasta, double, triple, quadruple, solitaire, all those kind of games.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, my grandparents were into Pinochle. My parents were big into Pinochle when they were a younger couple and they were together. They had friends. They would play every week. They would play Pinochle. But my grandmother, my mom's mother, was into cribbage. When I was 12 years old, I was a cribbage fanatic. I don't even remember how to play now, but I still have a wood cribbage board.
Well, that's funny. Yeah, I had an older friend that I was very close to. He was a fireman in Ithaca, New York, and he had this antique cribbage board at his house that he just, it was like his pride and joy. So I had never heard of it until I met him, and he showed me how to play. I never, back in those days, I was working two jobs and four kids and all that good stuff, so I never had any time to master that game, but I found it to be challenging, and I understood why he loved it so much. So have you
Were you on long enough to hear what our topic is today so you know the story about this young teenager?
Yeah, I lost you there for a minute. What were you saying?
Have you been on long enough, or have you been able to stay connected long enough to hear what we're talking about today, the life support scenario and some of the information in regard to this young teenage, this 13-year-old girl in California?
All right, back again. Sorry about that. Lost you again. At least it doesn't hang up on us anymore. It just kind of like my phone mutes
well,
you. I'm not doing it.
They told me this morning when I opened up my dashboard, they told me that they were having problems on the Blog Talk site. So
okay.
we may have some additional problems this morning other than just our phone thing. So although everything appears to be fine on my dashboard, but yeah.
Like I said, it's not hanging up on me anymore like it used to, so that's a good sign. All I have to do is I have to search for the call and it brings it back in, so that's pretty cool. So what were you saying? No, I didn't hear the entire story. I know that it's something about making a living will and whether or not people, you know, there should be extreme methods taken to keep somebody alive if they go brain dead or something. I guess that's what the call is about. But, you know, I missed the very, very beginning of what you were talking about.
Well, a couple weeks ago, I made the decision to do a show about this because there's a lot of controversy out there. And, of course, for as long as I can remember, they have when you go in to do a procedure in a hospital, they ask you if you have a living will. I mean, it's one of the, I don't know, the first 10 questions that they talk to you about when you have any kind of a procedure. So many, many years ago when I had my back surgery, I said, yes, they explained to me, and we've done shows about the difference between a will versus a living will and all that kind of stuff. So when I read this story that I'm going to share right now about this young woman, she's 13 years old and she lives in Northern California, she went in for a routine tonsillectomy and ended up bleeding in her brain. I have yet to read anything that really explains to me. I guess there is no explanation as to why that happened to her. But it was left in the hands of the judge. The parents don't want her disconnected. The hospital does. So they went to a court. So it prompted me to ask the question as to who really has that say and who really, if there is no living will, who really can give to or take away in a scenario like this? And
let
I
me
found.
Ask you a question before you go into that, how long ago did this happen?
This just recently happened. The hearing was the 20th of December, but she.
It might change after you read the article, but I can't believe that when you're talking about a child, even.
No, I lost you, Shell. This is going to be difficult this morning if this keeps happening. But I'm going to read this story, and hopefully, Shell is able to stay with us and hear everything. Are you there now?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can, but I couldn't for the last several seconds.
Okay. I understand where I'm going. I can't believe that any decision other than the parents would even be considered. So this story is a little shocking to me.
Mm-hmm. It was to me as well because the mom is devastated. And we are talking about a 13-year-old, and we are talking about a time in our lives when innovations and techniques are changing second by second. So I certainly can understand the feeling of the parents. On a quick side note, several weeks ago I talked about a friend of the family, somebody that grew up with my kids, and I've known him since he was 12 or 13 years old. And his 13-year-old son had a severe asthma attack, and he ended up in the hospital. He is still in the hospital.
he ended up having surgery on one of his lungs because they found several problems with his lungs, holes and things like that in his lungs that they had to go in and repair. I mean, he was, he almost died. And
right.
he posted a picture of him yesterday on Facebook laying in his hospital bed with his dad laying beside him on the bed. And but there's a perfect scenario. I mean, he could have lost consciousness because he wasn't breathing good. And you know, there can be a disconnect with your brain wanting to shut down because your brain knows something's not working. So what if somebody else had made that decision when something like that happened? I mean, that little boy, you know, might be gone. So all of this, and I understand, or what I got from all the different reports that I read, and like I said, there's one that I'm going to kind of go over, but it's like, oh my God, it's like reading a, I don't know, like a legal document that is like repetitive and contradictive and all, through the whole thing. So you end up with really no answers, just a lot more questions. So, but let me read this story first because this, my heart goes out to these people. Unbelievable what's going on with them. The uncle of a 13-year-old Northern California girl declared brain dead by a judge today says he's hoping for a Christmas Eve miracle. Well, that hasn't happened. Christmas Eve has come and gone. Jahi McMath's family says she bled profusely and went into cardiac arrest following a tonsillectomy. They've been fighting to prevent Children's Hospital in Oakland, California, from taking her off life support. The judge sided with the hospital today after hearing from two doctors, but has given the teen's family until 5 p.m. December 30th to file an appeal. She will stay on life support until then. The doctors testified today that the teen couldn't breathe on her own. When the ventilator was briefly removed during tests, she couldn't breathe at all. Judge Grillo expressed his sympathy but said he was powerless to order the hospital to keep Jahi on life support. The girl's uncle says he and the family would discuss and decide whether to appeal or to allow the hospital to remove Jahi from the ventilator. A court-appointed doctor testified on Tuesday that 13-year-old Jahi McMath is brain dead after suffering complications following a tonsillectomy. Dr. Paul Graham Fisher says Jahi McMath meets all the criteria of brain death. Fisher's evaluation was the second to reach that conclusion. Again, no explanation whatsoever as to how, why, or what could have happened to have these kind of results. You know, I mean, a tonsillectomy. I thought doctors could do tonsillectomies, with one hand and do something else with the other. That's how...
How old was this young girl?
13.
All right, that's why. Anytime you get into teenage years, I had a tonsillectomy when I was 16, and I had to be in the hospital for 3 days. I hemorrhaged, and obviously I didn't have a stroke or anything like that. But when you're older, when you're in your teens, anytime you go into the teen years, it causes blood pressure problems, and that's why it's very, very hazardous for a teenager or an adult to have a tonsillectomy. When you're talking about a little kid, I don't know why the complications aren't there, but they were actually very concerned about doing the tonsillectomy on me because I was very sick, and I ended up being in the hospital for 3 days after the tonsillectomy because I kept hemorrhaging. They couldn't stop me from bleeding.
Mm-hmm.
It was pretty traumatic. I remember it.
Yeah, I had a friend who had a tonsillectomy when he was, I guess we were like 18 or 19, right around there. And yes, he was like incredibly ill, and he too was in the hospital for 3 days. I didn't actually pull that together. That's an interesting fact. I can't imagine why it is unless the... As you grow, the tonsils become more of a an extremity instead of just a place to catch disease and viruses. That's what I've always had explained to me, and that's what I've read, that a tonsil was a place to catch some of the garbage that grows in your throat. That's plain.
Well, see, what really happens when you have to have a tonsillectomy means the rest of the immune system isn't functioning, and the tonsils are becoming overloaded. So usually when somebody needs a tonsillectomy, it means their immune system is already compromised. Otherwise, other glands in the body and other parts of the elimination process would be helping to get rid of the toxins. So it's always an indication that the immune system is being overwhelmed. So when you understand that if somebody needs a tonsillectomy, that their immune system is already compromised, and the blood pressure can spike, and things, she probably had a stroke. I can't think of anything else that would cause bleeding on the brain, but there must have been some sort of a blood pressure issue in her particular case. It's the only thing I can make a supposition about.
There are a couple things that are answered as I read through this, but it's still like shocking. But I now that you've reminded me of that, it made me think of Randy. And yeah, he was. I was in and out. I was two when I had a tonsillectomy, and they took me in, and I didn't even spend the night. My mom was with me the whole time. My dad was with me. They did the tonsillectomy and sent me home, and I was great. I mean, I, of course, I was only two, but almost three, I guess, because it was summer, and I would have turned three in September. So, but it is interesting, and I think maybe that is a part of it. Maybe it becomes more of an extremity than just a poison catcher after you get to be, you know, a certain age. I don't know. But I'm going to keep researching on this anyway as I do other things, because I just find it to be kind of weird. But your input was valuable because I didn't know some of that other stuff. Children's Hospital of Oakland filed court papers late Monday asking that the girl be taken off life support after doctors there also concluded that she was brain dead. Her family wants to keep the 13-year-old connected to a breathing machine and has asked for another opinion on her condition. Jahi McMath was declared brain dead after experiencing complications following a December 9th, that's when she had the surgery, tonsillectomy at Children's Hospital in Oakland. An Alameda County judge on Monday called for Jahi to be independently examined by Fisher, the chief of child neurology at Stanford University School of Medicine. On December 12th, doctors concluded the girl was brain dead and since then have wanted to remove her from life support. Jahi's family wants to keep her hooked up to a respirator and eventually have her moved to another facility. The family said it believes she is still alive and that the hospital should not remove her from the ventilator without its permission, without their permission, I'm sure that's supposed to say. It's wrong for someone who made mistakes on your child to just call the coroner and not respect the family's feelings or rights. Sandra Chapman, Jahi's grandmother and a registered nurse, said in the hallway outside the courtroom, "I know Jahi suffered, and it tears me up." Jahi's mom said last week the girl feared she would not wake up after the surgery. Gosh, that poor family. The family's attorney also asked Judge Grillo to allow a third evaluation by Paul Byrne, a pediatric professor at the University of Toledo. The hospital's attorney objected to Byrne, saying he's not a pediatric neurologist. Byrne is the co-editor of the 2001 book Beyond Brain Death, which presents a variety of arguments against using brain-based criteria for declaring a person dead. I've read about him. In a phone interview, Byrne said he would not comment in detail because he had not seen any of Jahi's medical records. But the fact that her ventilator is still functioning properly is a sign that she is alive, he said. The ventilator won't work on a corpse. In a corpse, the ventilator pushes the air in, but it won't come out. Just the living person pushes the air out. Well, that's quite a comment. Jahi's family says the girl bled profusely after the tonsillectomy and then went into cardiac arrest before being declared brain dead. Outside the courtroom, Durand and Jahi's surgery was very complex, not simply a tonsillectomy. It was more complicated than a tonsillectomy, Durand said. He refused to elaborate, citing health care privacy laws. That's convenient. Arthur Kaplan, who leads the Division of Medical Ethics at New York University Langone Medical Center and is not involved in Jahi's case, told the Associated Press that once brain death has been declared, a hospital is under no obligation to keep a patient on a ventilator. Brain death is death, he said, adding. They don't need permission from the family to take her off, but because the little girl died unexpectedly and so tragically, they're trying to soften the blow and let the family adjust to the reality. Often families confuse brain death with a coma or a permanent vegetative state, Kaplan said. A coma is like a television that has a picture with a lot of interference. There's brain activity, but something's not right. A permanent vegetative state is when the screen is all snow. Brain death is when the set is unplugged. There is nothing on the screen. Keeping Jahi on a ventilator is also likely to cost thousands of dollars a day, Kaplan added. And because she has been declared brain dead, it's unlikely to be covered by insurance. So that last paragraph is probably the biggest truth in this whole story. Do you agree?
Yeah. But they did say something very interesting, which it just hit me just before you said it, is that are we talking a coma or actual brain death? Because I don't know if I've ever heard of anybody coming back from brain death. We hear all the time people waking up from comas, but are there any stories of people that have come back after being determined to be brain dead?
Well, apparently this one doctor that I mentioned, the one that the family had read about and wants to have him involved in this scenario, has been around for a long time. The book that he wrote, Beyond Brain Death, which presents a variety of arguments against using brain-based criteria for declaring a person dead. And it's very interesting what he says about the breathing. However, if I sit here and evaluate it from a layman perspective, if I push air into a balloon and don't seal the end of the balloon, it comes back out, right? I mean, that's rubber, and maybe that would be the deciding factor. So let's say we pushed air into a paper bag and you know, like blew up the paper bag. You know how you blow up a paper bag and you smack it to make the popping noise?
Right.
If you blew up the paper bag, would the air just come rushing back out? No, come rushing back out.
Right.
I don't know. I can understand the controversy for sure.
Well, the other two things, and why don't you finish the article first? Because I do have two comments to make, but I don't want to interrupt the flow of the article.
No, that was the end of it. That last paragraph that I read was the end of it,
well,
and the money that it's going to cost to keep her on a ventilator.
And I think that has a lot to do with why the hospital is moving forward. Number one, they probably really don't think there's any chance she can come to, because I think it's probably a very rare instance that it's ever happened. But two things come to mind is that, you know, I watch these shows like Unsolved Mysteries and stuff like that, and they show all this stuff that happens that, like, really has no explanation. And this has happened more than once, by the way. And we're not talking somebody in a coma or brain dead. We're talking about somebody with modern-day equipment that's pronounced dead. I mean, they're dead. They're being shipped off. And, you know, an hour later or 20 minutes later, they're in the coroner's office or they're in the ambulance, and they regain consciousness as if they were never dead to begin with. They have full cognitive abilities, no brain damage, whatever. What, I don't remember if it was a man or a woman. I wish I could remember what show it was, but they actually were interviewing this woman. I think it was a woman, and she was declared dead. She was being transported to the coroner's office in the back of an ambulance. They hit a bump, I think the ambulance got in a car and got in an accident, and the gurney that the man was strapped to was thrown out of the back of the ambulance and hit the ground. Somehow that compression restarted the man's heart, and all of a sudden he's on this gurney, because he was strapped onto the gurney, he's on this gurney screaming for somebody to get him up the gurney. He was completely alive. He had full mental faculties, but he had been pronounced dead. And they've had other situations where people have woken up in a coroner's office and just sat right up and started talking to them, like, what the hell am I doing here? You know, thank God it happened, obviously, before they started cutting on them. And this is one of the reasons why they embalm people, so that they don't accidentally bury somebody who is, in fact, still alive. You know, that's where the whole cliche comes from, a dead ringer. You know, people were being buried alive, you know, way, way back when. And so they would put strings into the coffin attached to a bell in case somebody was buried alive. All they had to do was ring the bell, and there were people that would monitor the graveyards because they would dig people up, and they would see that a person had been buried alive at some point. So that's bombing became a practice, stuff like that, to prevent that. But the bottom line is, I find that fascinating that a person can go into a state where our modern technological equipment cannot pick up any signs of life, and yet there is some life there. And 20 minutes later, an hour later, somehow this person regains full life force into their body, but yet it had been there all along and our machines couldn't detect it. That's both exciting and frightening at the same time.
Well, and I think everything you and I talk about that pertains to human beings, their functions, their intellect, their ability to we've read some amazing stories, we've discussed some amazing things. The truth is that because we're all so completely different, one really never knows. And I'm persuaded by everything you and I have discussed over the past year, and the things that we knew at the Institute and things that life has taught us, that there is no absolute positive about dying. There just isn't. I mean, how many stories have we read? And you're right, of course, comatose, and the description that the one guy writes about the television screen makes a lot of sense. And, of course, that has to do with the connectivity. But we're not talking about a plug that can be manually removed. We're talking about a plug that disconnects in the human body for maybe many reasons. Maybe to just get the screen to quit being so hot, and then it's going to come back on. I don't know. And the sad part about it is all these people with all these educations and all these experimental things and all the procedures that they've done through the years, they don't really know either.
That's the truth of it, is that they don't know. And they're setting criteria based on educated guesses, but they don't know, because there are so many exceptions to the rule. There's so many people that have shown that there really isn't anything such as brain death. Just because they're not picking up anything doesn't mean that the person can't come back. The other tragic thing is that sometimes from brain death or coma, a person will come back and be vegetative and have no, have no mental faculties. I know that people have come back from comas. I know that people have actually come back from being pronounced dead, I mean, completely dead, but I'm not 100% positive about a vegetative state. Has anybody ever come back from a completely vegetative state to having full cognitive abilities? Do you know if there's any stories with regard to that?
Then that's up to the description that is given by any hospital. And one hospital who says somebody's in a vegetative state doesn't even use that that terminology. They just say, you know, so-and-so is in a coma and can't function and isn't breathing on their own. They're on a ventilator that keeps their lungs going up and down. So
again, it has to do with the perception of the people that are involved. The more this one report that I pulled off, it was really quite long. So there was like 30 pages, and I chose like six. And, I mean, they go on and on. Where state law to prevent the provision of palliative care, which is a big part of this, you know, this decision to move on, palliative care means purely and simply that you're going to keep somebody comfortable. But there are many times when there's no clear resolution as to how somebody is living in that state of mind, if you will. If they're in a coma, but they need help breathing because they have, let's say they have lung cancer. Let's say, like my sister, they have a tumor strangling a part of their respiratory system or a part of their body, in, you know, prohibits the filling of air in their lungs. So it's too iffy, Shell. There's too many factors. So at the end of the day, this is what I tried to find out and have not been able to, because everybody is different. Every state has a different set of procedures. But if that's my kid, I want to make damn sure you're right, because I don't know whether you're right or wrong. And I don't think that you're doing it with any kind of from any bad place. You're doing your job. And you have certain pieces of equipment that can tell you this, that, and the other thing. But the truth of the matter is you don't know. And what parent isn't going to want to side with the chance that there's a chance? Who isn't going to do
that? Yeah, that the child's in a coma, not brain dead, that type of thing. Because comas, people recover from. And we hear it in the news all the time.
Or the brain activity has ceased. I mean, if you go into a coma, the way it was explained to me when my son was in a coma was that the brain shuts down so that the rest of the body can heal. And if your brain isn't listening to the complaints coming from your body, it's less stressful. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay. So now who's to say that the brain simply doesn't unplug and say, oh, boy, This body, you know, something's going on way down there in the right leg, or something's going on anywhere, and says, you know, let's give this body a chance to rest. And so it disconnects. We talk about the disconnections in our bodies all the time, the fact that it's an electrical current, and the fact that him saying unplugged just made so much sense to me, because I'm sorry, but I think it's very possible. And, of course, I am, like, so far down on the intellect totem pole, but because of that, able to look at things from a perspective of simple. And
one of the family members, when you were reading the article, one of the things that caught my attention is that one of the family members, I think it was, like, two times at least, two or three times, made the comment that the hospital made a mistake. And I was like, has it been divulged that the hospital did in fact make a mistake? Because that's what the family member said. Is that what the family is assuming, or was some mistake divulged and admitted to by the hospital?
There is none of the stories, and there's many of them on the internet, all from different points of view. None of them have accused or accepted any kind of responsibility on the part of the hospital.
So the family may just be assuming that because it was a young child, and how could a young child have this happen unless the hospital did something wrong? That's probably where the family's going. Because she didn't say what they did wrong. She just said that they make a mistake and now they want to, you know, unplug this child. And it's so that's kind of what they're railing against. But, you know, go ahead.
You and I can understand where they're coming from. I mean, like I said in the beginning, and you reminded me about the seriousness of having a tonsillectomy once you are in the preteen or teen or even adult age arena, then it's different. It's not so, if you'll excuse the pun, cut and dried. So I think that maybe that has some pull in the parent's decision, for sure. It would for me. I think it would for any. But the point is this happened, what was the date I said? 9th. So it hasn't even been 3 weeks, right? December 9th, today's the 26th. Well, it's just been a little short of 3 weeks since this happened, and I don't blame them. I would want them to do everything for a short time, if nothing else, and maybe that's what needs to happen here. Somebody needs to intervene. Well, the judge did. He gave them until the 30th. So from the 9th to the 30th would be 21 days, which is 3 weeks, right?
Right. When, and at least I'm not so sure that I'm comfortable with the judge's decision, but what I am comfortable with is that he didn't make it an immediate order, because I've heard of that happening where the judge makes a decision and the order is for 3 o'clock that afternoon or something. So at least he bought the family time to research this, find people that they might be able to make an effective appeal with. So this is going to be an ongoing story. I'm interested as to what the family might find. And wouldn't it be a wonderful thing if somehow this child, during that time frame, did regain consciousness? I mean, we've heard, my mom told me a story yesterday. It was on one of these, one of the shows she's watched, where they show recoveries against all odds. And this woman was crippled, I think it was like 15 years ago. And I forgot what the type of accident it was, but bottom line is she broke her back and severed some things in her spinal cord and everything. But she had this like phenomenal attitude. She always believed that someday she would walk again, even though the doctors told her it would never, never happen. She was in a wheelchair, and she would slump over to the side because she didn't even have enough to keep her upright. And almost spontaneously, she kept praying. And this is why you and I have discussed this before. I really believe in the power of prayer, especially when you have groups praying for somebody. And all of a sudden, 15 years later, one day she thought she could stand up out of the wheelchair, and she just did. And it was like she actually walked into the room where her kids were, and her son said he almost fainted dead away, because here she hadn't walked in 15 years. She couldn't even sit upright in the wheelchair. But she prayed with faith. She didn't pray like, please grant me this. She prayed like, I'm glad I survived this, and I'm grateful, and I want to walk again. But she prayed. She knew that at some point it would happen. So for 15 years, she never acted like a victim. She never felt sorry for herself, because she knew that eventually she would walk, and then all of a sudden one day she just did. But it went from her being in the wheelchair to standing up and walking like overnight. And they were interviewing her and her kids and stuff. So it was a remarkable story. But I've heard of other stories like that, with these spontaneous recoveries of people that have been crippled, where the doctor said, no, you're never going to walk again. There's a permanent severing here of your spine. That's it. You can never. You're going to be crippled for the rest of your life. And 2 years later, 5 years later, the person's up and walking, and the doctors can't make sense out of it. Yeah, there's a lot of documented cases with regard to that. So with all we know technologically, there's still so much that's special about our physical bodies, about the energy that drives these vehicles, whether you want to call it the soul or whatever. And medical science doesn't always have the accurate take on what's happened to somebody. And that's just a fact.
Well, two times in my life, my son Michael and his son Michael, if I'd have listened to the powers that be, physicians that have taken care of hundreds of people who have been in a coma, physicians who have taken care of hundreds of people who have been burnt badly, I would have given up hope the first 24 hours if I'd have listened to all of them.
Right.
What I know to be a true, clean, hard fact is you don't know the person laying on that table. I don't care how good a doctor you are, how good a nurse you are, how good a specialist you are, you do not know the person on that table. And that, in my life, has been proven to me more than once. So,
right.
I think I shared this story. This is about a family pet. He was hit by a car. And he was barely breathing, bleeding from his nose and his ears. We lived out in the country. It was wintertime. Big Spike carried him out behind our garage and shot him on the top of his head. And right after that happened, I came home with all the kids. He left the dog out in the back of our garage and came in and told all of us what happened. Diana was a little girl. She cried for hours. I cried. The boys cried. That was a Friday night. We all got past it. Saturday, business as usual, and the ground is too frozen, so Spike can't dig a grave for the dog. So Sunday, we get up early in the morning, and we're going to go to our favorite restaurant and have breakfast, kind of a way to get the kids' mind off of everything that had happened. The kids go out the back door. I walk around the front door to come down the driveway into our garage, and Diana is standing there and says, "Mommy, that wasn't very funny for you to tell us that Saddle was dead." And I went, "What?" And I turned around. There stands the dog. This is a
yeah, I remember the story.
There stands the dog. I faint in the driveway. And Spike comes running out. He looks at me. They get me up. The kids are all smiling from ear to ear. I think for a long time, until they got older and we could discuss it, they thought it was a very in poor taste joke on their father's and my part.
Wow.
The dog never could hear again, because when Spike shot him, apparently he closed his eyes and just grazed. I could see abrasions on the top of the dog's head. But the dog lived another, I don't know, 2 or 3 years.
Wow.
So you never know. You truly never know. While we've been talking, too, I found this site. It's a legal site, and it says, despite the outcome and the trend it represents, we recommend that physicians reject unilateral action. In other words, don't just follow procedure for everyone, write it down on a piece of paper and say that's what you're going to do. Such actions certainly may be considered ethically appropriate if they support professional integrity, the obligation of each physician to define the moral practice of medicine. Nevertheless, autonomy remains the first ethical principle for removing life-sustaining treatment, even though most critically ill patients must exercise their autonomy through surrogates because they cannot make medical decisions themselves. Ethics here reflects law, because informed consent and informed refusal are the primary legal principles that justify this practice. In other words, professional input is to where the patient or the person involved in this is sitting health-wise. And unilateral action.
It's talking legal ethics, not morality. There's a difference.
Exactly. But even still, they side with us in this paragraph. Unilateral action can also be risky. Disagreements between families and physicians can increase the potential for legal action, and even an unsuccessful lawsuit imposes significant burdens. Finally, negotiation almost always works to resolve even the most contentious disputes. So, and again, what's the most important part about that whole paragraph is the fact that they're asking for time to
right.
make this time for the family to feel like they're not ending the life of a child when the child might still be in there someplace. And I absolutely positively get that. And 3 weeks is a very, very short time in a big picture.
That's
a
right.
Very, very short time. So,
you know, the thing is that I mean, some of these people I've known personally. I remember one of them was when I was like in my 20s, and I lived up in New York. I was working at a repair shop, and there was a woman who was a long-standing customer of ours. She had a 16-year-old son, and he was like clowning around with a motorbike on the front lawn of their house, and he flipped the bike, hit his head on the grass. He wasn't even on the concrete. He just flipped the bike over, landed on his head. And he died three hours later at the hospital. I mean, he just never recovered from it. And they could never understand how such a light bump on his head could have killed him. And then I knew of another man who got in a catastrophic car accident, was in a coma for 3 weeks, came to 3 weeks later. They thought he was brain dead. They thought that they were trying to unplug him. Not only did he recover, but he recovered with complete cognitive abilities, like nothing had ever happened. He wasn't crippled. He had no permanent disabilities from it whatsoever, and the hospital almost unplugged him. So it's like, you know, you just never know. It, like you said before, it really is a case by case, and unfortunately hospitals don't work case by case. They look at statistics. They say, you know, the first 99 people who had these readings didn't live past 2 days, so this person's not going to live. But there are so many situations out there that go against statistics, that are exceptions to the rule, that all you have to have is one person that's an exception to the rule, and it should really rewrite the statistics, but it doesn't. And they still have this, you know, these scenarios that they believe are more common, and that's what they act upon.
Mm-hmm. Well, but that's the whole point that last little article was trying to make. You know, in truth, the best way to work through anything like that is with lots of discussions, a little bit of time, and a little bit of compassion directed towards the family of something like this, because this is not, the family's world is not one of cut and dried facts. The family's world is a world of love and protection, and is what it is. So if you are the doctor or the deciding fact or the judge in a scenario like this, all of those things have to be taken into consideration. And a good, I know I always end up with this, but it's really what I believe, a good long talk with questions answered and feelings addressed and all the things that go with a horrible, horrible scenario like this will help in the long run. They're not going to say to you, no problem, take her off the ventilator. She's alive. She'll survive. That's not going to happen. You're not going to hear those words. And you're
right.
Not going to, Aaron is never going to have those feelings. But to sit and talk with somebody and say, look, I don't blame you. If that was my kid, I would say do this as long as it takes until they open their eyes and look at me. Because you're no longer in the world of facts. You're in the world of love and support, and that's where you're going to stay. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. The guy who wrote the book, Beyond Brain Death, do you know, because I don't know if they gave any details, is it just his theory or opinion, or does he actually write about people that have been termed brain dead and then ended up regaining life, basically? Do you know if he gives any examples, or is it just his theory?
It doesn't. Well, I mean, obviously they researched. I can't imagine somebody saying something like that because, just for the hell of it, I would guess. Let me get back to that point. In a phone interview, Byrne said he would not comment in detail because he had not seen any of Jahi's medical records. But the fact that her ventilator is still functioning properly is a sign that she is alive, he said. So that statement right there kind of tells me that he has some, he's had some experience with other things happening. However, maybe that would be a good place to go. I will see if I can find some more information on that particular book and and share that tomorrow on Recap Day, because I do. And again, like I said, you know, giving up is easy, and saying something is so to make yourself feel better about giving up is also easy.
Right.
We all do things in everyday interactions. But when you're talking about, I mean, imagine, put yourself in a place where your kid is, their tonsils are enlarged, they keep on getting infected, making them very uncomfortable. I've seen tonsils that are so big that I don't know how the child swallows or gets anything down their throat. So your pediatrician says, you know, we need to do a tonsillectomy. We probably should have done it 3 or 4 years ago. I'm sorry we waited this long. It's a little bit sketchier when they get to be 13 or 14. But with today's modern medicine, we can go in there and take care of this so that she doesn't struggle with this anymore. So any good parent, first of all, has chosen a doctor that they trust and they believe in, and they say, okay. So then they go through this procedure, and this happens. Now, if you can all put yourself in that place, we are so capable of taking on guilt when we make decisions for people that we are responsible for. We can be consumed with it. There's no reason that we should take responsibility, but we do, because they're thinking, we should have let her live with those damn tonsils. You know, she was functioning all right with those tonsils. Maybe we should have waited until we saw another specialist. Can you imagine how many things that they're saying to themselves? So buying them some time, yes, may cost the hospital a little bit of money, but I think the hospital's going to be out a large sum of money after this. So they need to rethink about how they're dealing with this very, very personal, very, very sad situation. And just saying, you know, our ventilator can be used someplace else is not the right answer. So I will check out this book. Sounds like it may be very interesting to all of us. So maybe we can even see if we can find the book. That would be awesome. Of course, Shelley's my reader. I'm a scanner. I don't seem to be able to find enough time to sit and read a book. I used to read all the time. I don't do much reading anymore. I do a lot of research on the internet, but I scan until I find something that makes sense to me, and I don't read every single article.
Well, actually, interestingly enough, one of the sections in my book is about how the brain functions from an emotional and mental standpoint. So I'm doing some of the research, like from Daniel Pink, who is a science writer. He writes a lot about brain research, and Ron Boyle, who has these courses out called Brain Train 1, 2, and 3, and he takes a lot of Daniel Pink's research and condenses it down to like layman terms, from scientific terms to layman terms, so that the common person can actually gain benefit. You know, our brains are like computers. If you know how to use them, you get more function out of them. So this would be an interesting piece to possibly cover in that section with regard to brain activity. So I would be interested in reading this book and seeing if it has any relevance for that section of my book.
And like you just said, it's like somebody did mention this book to me. I keep having a memory flashback about somebody talking to me. It wasn't you, though, huh? It wasn't you that said something to me already about this particular book?
No,
I remember.
Yeah, there's a couple others, but I like Daniel Pink and Daniel Amen. Kind of ironic, they're both Daniel. But Daniel Pink is a science writer. Daniel Amen is a doctor who writes a lot about the science behind how spirituality affects the brain. You know, and not advocating any particular religion, but that there's actually a difference in the way a person's brain functions when they're praying and they have faith over somebody who is like an atheist or who has no spiritual ties or something like that, that there's actually, when they scan the brains, there's actually a difference to the functioning of the brain. And that's why people that have some spiritual connection tend to heal faster and things like that. So it's a fascinating book, but it's from a clinical standpoint. It's from like how the brain functions and how spirituality actually affects the physical brain. So fascinating books. But Daniel Amen is the one who writes about those. So I'm actually reading both sets of books right now.
Okay. Well, we're out of time, actually. We're completely out of time. So I want to very, very interesting topic, I think, and could affect all of us at some point in time in our lives. So I think it'd be a great idea if we continued on this and got some more information, and we will share it when we do. Everybody, go out there and have a great day. I hope nobody's standing in return lines today. My suggestion to you would be don't do it today. It's going to be awful out there. But God bless, and everybody, have a great day. We'll be back tomorrow. Bye-bye. Bye, honey.
All right.
Talk to you later.
Bye, Renee. Everyone have a wonderful day. Talk to you tomorrow.